Lecture 6, Regal Society.
Hello again, and welcome to the 6th lecture in the History of Ancient Rome. The last time we looked at the traditions concerning the kings of Rome, 7 in number, according to the stories, and we also examined the question, difficult and hotly debated question, of how believable, how historical those various traditions and stories about the kings are. I'll leave the final decision on that difficult issue to you all individually, and I want to move on today to examine the shape of this early Roman society. There are many features of later Roman society that the Romans themselves considered to be very old, very ancient, and which most scholars would accept were in fact very old and may go back to this very earliest phase of Roman history, may go back to the regal period. And that's what I want to focus on today. I want to look first of all at the general shape of Roman society, which we'll see was typically archaic, that is to say typical for a period of around 600, 500 BC or so. Then we will look at some of the peculiar institutions, some of the peculiar aspects, facets of Roman society that were really unique in many ways to the Romans themselves. Then we look at the broad shape of politics as it seems to have been played out at this early period. And we'll end by taking an example, the Servian, the so-called Servian constitution, or Servian reforms, which we'll use as an example to show the difficulties of trying to interpret the data as we have it for this early period of Roman society. The regal society of Rome, so far as we can reconstruct it again, was typically archaic. It was dominated by aristocratic landowners. There seems to have been, from the start, a division between free and slave. It does seem that the Romans were a slaving society from very early on, as were, well, most societies, as we'll see when we come to look at the depressing question of slavery in ancient Rome. It's unfortunately the case that most societies in human history have been slaving societies. But they don't seem to have been particularly numerous, the slaves in this very early period of ancient Rome. But there was a division between free and, or at least freeborn, and slave. And that's the most basic division that seems to have existed in this early society. Within the freeborn population, there was a division, a distinction between the citizen and the non-citizen. Now, throughout this entire course, when I say citizen, I'll be referring to the adult male population of Rome who were enfranchised, who were allowed the vote, and were allowed to take part in the political process, and had various judicial and legal rights that non-citizens did not possess. Again, the citizen body of ancient Rome was always a restricted body of adult male citizens. Excluded were all women, obviously slaves, and any foreigners who had come to Rome and were not members of the citizen body, i.e., I suppose, alien residents is what they'd be called, or resident aliens would be what they'd be called today. This citizen body appears from earliest times to have been divided into units called tribes. Again, this terminology is quite difficult. I'm not referring to the tribal societies that I talked about when we looked at pre-Roman Italy, the non-urbanized tribal societies like, say, the Samnites in central Italy. Rather, these units are called tribes because the Latin word is tribus, which means it appears to be derived from the word three. It appears to mean by threes. And this would make sense since we hear that the Roman citizen body was initially divided into three units called tribes. These seem to have been voting units. Units that were used for the constitution of a popular assembly for the purposes of voting. So they're called tribes. I know that the terminology is a wee bit confusing since we've looked at tribal societies, but that's not what I'm talking about here. When I talk about the citizen tribes or the voting tribes, I'm talking about these divisions of citizens into voting units. So there were originally three of these tribes, it seems, from the very earliest times. One of the chief duties of citizenship that fell upon all citizens was military service. If you had privileges as a citizen, you also had obligations. And those obligations in all archaic societies, high up on the list, is military service. If the call to arms comes, you collect your equipment, because you're not supplied by the state, and you show up on the appointed day, enroll in the army, and go off and fight whoever it is. If you happen to be a citizen living under Tullus Hostilius, it seems, then you've spent quite a lot of your summer time out in the fields beating up on your neighbours. seems that the Romans at this early stage, this is a point that we'll come back to, but it seems that the Romans at this very earliest stage fought in the formation called the phalanx, which is a Greek-style, tightly packed body of heavily armored soldiers with large round shields and using spears predominantly as an offensive weapon. The idea of the phalanx is to advance upon your enemy in a single mass and quite literally shove them off the field. It's when the opposing army breaks that most of the killing is done. There's a period of shoving, and then when the other line breaks, then you do a lot of the killing. But more of that when we come to look at Roman warfare and the Roman army. Other archaic societies, particularly those that are better documented, like in Greece, it seems that the landowning, wealthy families dominated this early society. These families, and all the common families as well, were grouped into units called, well, we call them clans. The Latin word is gens, plural gentes, and they've been translated into English as clans. These are very, very unclear units for us today, but it's very hard to us to appreciate where this idea came from. We know that the clans were often organized around a particular religious shrine. It may have originally been a religious grouping at its soul, but it's really very hard to make out where this organization came from. And when we talk about a clan, we're talking about a group of families who share, as we'll see, who share a name and are identified as members of X or Y clan. So the origins of this clan system then, most obscure, its exact function is most obscure, but it seems that all Roman citizen bodies were members of clans, some of them prominent, some of them less prominent. I mentioned to you the issue of the Roman name, and it's worth bringing that into play now, because the Roman name reflects the dominance of the clan system. Traditionally, your typical Roman citizen would have three names. I'll pick an example. Lucius Cornelius Sulla would be a typical Roman name. But the name actually is more than just an identification like Joe Smith or Joe Bloggs or Helen Schaefer or whatever. The name actually identifies you in the social cosmos. It locates you in the Roman hierarchical social order. The most important name of the three names of the Roman is the middle one. It's just called the name, sometimes called the clan name. This is the name, so in the case of Lucius Cornelius Sulla, that's named Cornelius. That tells you that this person is a member of the Cornelian clan. That's a prominent clan. That's an important clan. You know immediately hearing that name, this is a person of importance. The name in front of the main name is called the praenomen, which means the name in front. And that is the name that identifies you as an individual. Lucius. So with Lucius Cornelius, we get the information you are the individual Lucius of the clan Cornelius. The Romans, by the way, had very few of these four names. So few, in fact, that they're often abbreviated, as they are in your booklets, by single letters. Lucius, for instance, is L. Titus is T. Marcus is M. Quintus as Q, and so forth. So there were actually very few of those names. They weren't particularly imaginative when it came to naming people, at least naming individuals. So the praenomen, though, is the name that indicates your individual identity within the clan. And the third name seems originally to have been a nickname that was added on to certain branches of a clan, and so was generally identified as a family name. So you have Lucius Cornelius Sulla is Lucius from the clan Cornelius of the family Sulla that's in the clan Cornelius. Okay? Because you could also have another guy, say, called Publius Cornelius Scipio. Well, he's the individual Publius in the same clan Cornelius, but of the family Scipio. Different family, same clan. But the point that I'm driving home here is that it's the clan name that's the key one. That's the one that's called the name. Okay? And the other two names are in reference to it. One of the features of Roman society from this early period that was to live on throughout Roman history is a rather odd feature of Roman society, is the system called clientship. Clientela in the Latin. Clientship. Now, when I explain this to my students, I like to draw on an image from modern movies to explain how clientship works. Basically, clientship is a system of favor granting which results in an obligation being placed upon the person to whom the favor has been granted. I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine. That is the fundamental nature of it. It's a system of reciprocal arrangements between people. And the image that I always like to give my students is the opening scene of The Godfather. We have Don Corleone sitting passively in his study with various cap-ringing lollies brought before him to ask favors, and he either imperiously grants or denies the requests. If he grants the request, they're then under an obligation to him. From that, okay, it's a criminal obligation. I'm not saying that ancient clientship was one big mafia organization. But the essence of that relationship that's being expressed in The Godfather is really what clientship is about. You go to someone who has influence or power to help you. You ask them for a favor. That's the literal Latin word, beneficium, a benefit, a favor. And then once that is done, you are under an obligatio, an obligation to them, to support them. Or do whatever it is that they may want you to do. It might be political support, it might be to help build a barn on the farm, whatever. When the time comes for you to pay back the favor, you do it. You become the client of a patron. The person granting the favor is a patron. The person accepting the favor, now under the obligation, is the client. Clientela, clientship, helped offset the horizontal stratification in Roman society. It created vertical connections between prominent and lowly families. And so the centrifugal forces that might threaten to tear a really hierarchical society apart were somewhat offset by this system of favor granting. I should point out that inherent in the system is the expectation that the client has something to offer. You don't grant a favor to someone who can do nothing for you in return. So as a result, the poorest and destitute members of society will tend to be left out of this system. Not everyone was involved in a patron-client relationship. In many ways, it's a relationship between parties of relative degrees of influence. More influence granting help to people of lesser influence that can then be utilized if the people with more influence need it in the future. Another feature of Roman society that appears to have gone back to the very earliest periods is the organization of people into groups called orders. Orders. By orders, I'm using the phrase in the Latin term ordo, plural ordines, which means a rank, a status, a rank within a society. And by tradition, there were two orders in the very earliest periods of Roman history, the patricians and the plebeians. Most scholars are of the opinion that the plebeians didn't actually come into existence as an order until later. And we look, in fact, at the possible emergence of the plebeians in the later lecture. But it does seem that the patricians are very old indeed, and may indeed go back to the earliest periods, back to the regal period of Roman history. The patricians were a group of clans defined by birth. In other words, your patrician status came with you with your name. It was identifiable with your name immediately. For instance, the Cornelii were all patricians. So any member of the clan Cornelius was automatically a patrician. So was the clan Julius, for instance. Or the clan Claudius. Claudius was also a patrician name. And other names would be automatically recognized as being non-patrician, later designated as plebeian. Well, goodness, the question, where did the patriciate, where did the system of patricians come from, is, you won't be surprised to hear, hotly debated. Various theories have been advanced over the years, sometimes theories that reflect more the interests or inclinations of those advancing them than they do anything about the past. For instance, when racial theories of superiority were popular, well, what do we have? The patricians are obviously of decent, Aryan, hard-working stock, and the slovenly plebeians are your typical Mediterranean, shiftless types. Yeah. Absolute nonsense, not a single shred of evidence to support any racial distinction between the patricians and the plebeians. Other views have been, for instance, that the patricians were all the wealthy clans, and the plebeians were the poor. In other words, that there's an economic division. But that seems to be overly simplistic, and there's evidence for wealthy plebeian clans from early on in the history of the Republic. And so if the plebeians were around before that, the argument goes, it's unlikely that they just suddenly became wealthy out of nowhere. So the economic division between patricians and plebeians seems to be a bit simplistic and a bit naive. Whatever the case of the origin of these orders, it does seem that the patricians were around from the very earliest periods. And I reiterate, the plebeians, who later are designated as everyone who's not a patrician. That's a later designation. The origin of the plebeians, whether or not they were around early, as early as the patricians, that's a matter of considerable debate. and is unclear to us. Personally, I favour the view that the plebeians emerged slightly later in the early republic. But this we will look at when we examine the so-called struggle of the orders between the plebeians and the patricians in the early and middle republic. So what we have then, if we just pause to look at this sort of shape of Roman society before we examine the system of politics, what we have in early Roman society is already a fairly hierarchical system, social order. And this will be a mark of Roman society throughout its entire history. It was a rigidly hierarchical social order where status determined everything. If you were a patrician, you had advantages over non-patricians. If you were a citizen, you had advantages over non-citizen. If you were freeborn, you had advantages over slaves. We're dealing with a social order that's rigidly hierarchic and was to become even more so, but which is somewhat offset by the system of clientship between people of influence. Looking at the politics of the regal period, what we see is that, as we've seen already, the kings were chosen from among the Senate body and were granted their powers by ratification by popular vote. The Senate at this early stage is also much disputed. Was it a standing body in the state? Was it an ad hoc advisory council to the king convened as needed? Or did it meet regularly, twice a month, say? Most unclear as to whether or not the Senate was a regular standing body of the state. But certainly from its ranks were chosen the next candidates for the kingship, and the vote was taken by the people, who were into a popular committee, a popular assembly, known as the Comitia Curiata, which means the Curiate Assembly. This is because they were organized into 30 units called curiae. What's curia mean? We don't know. We wish we did. It just means a grouping, so far as we can tell. Curia, it's curious. There's no pun intended. Okay, there was. The Comitia Curiata, then, is literally the meeting of the people in their curiae. And there were 30 of them, as seemed to have been the case, 10 curiae per tribe. So you had 3 tribes originally, and then the tribes were subdivided into 10 units each called curiae, and when the vote came, the vote was taken by blocks, block voting. It was the curiae that voted, not the individuals. The individuals voted within their particular curia, but then it was the curial vote that was put forward. That's why it's called the Curiate Assembly, the assembly of people organized into voting units called curiae. The origins of this, again, are most unclear, but we have parallels for it in Greece and in other archaic societies. Even in some fairly rigid and monarchic societies, popular assemblies seem to have been a feature of these early archaic societies, so it's not surprising to find one in Rome. So the Comitia Curiata is the earliest of the popular assemblies. When we look at the Republic, we'll see that 3 more came to be added to that list. Yes, that's 3 more popular assemblies, but more of that anon. It's important as well to note that the main function of the Curiate Assembly is to ratify the choice of king, and then to confer upon that king the power of command. This power is called imperium in Latin, and we'll be seeing a lot more of this. Pay careful attention to this concept. Imperium is the quality of command. It allows you basically to order people around. It's got a very military feel to it. A general, for instance, in Latin is called an imperator, a man who wields imperium, a man who wields the power of command. And note that in the Roman tradition, it's the people who confer imperium. The people, the populus Romanus, convened into an official assembly, are the only ones who can confer the power of command upon someone. That's the main function of the Curiate Assembly. Ratify the Senate's choice of king and confer the power of command upon that king. By the way, as an aside, the word imperium might look vaguely familiar. It means the power of command. Then it came to mean the area over which the Romans had the power to command people. And so it's come into the English language as empire. And that's why we have empire and imperial, as opposed to imperial. Anyhow, That's an aside, a linguistic aside. Some of the difficulties of trying to sort out the social, political and military details of the Surly period are nicely illustrated, I believe, by consideration of what's called the Servian Constitution or the Servian Reforms. We saw in the last lecture how the King Servius Tullius was accredited in the tradition with basically inventing Rome's social and military system. Well, when Livy and another source that was contemporary with Livy, a man called Dionysius of Halicarnassus, he wrote in Greek, but he wrote about Roman antiquities in Greek, and was a contemporary of Livy, so he's writing at about the same time or so. These two gentlemen described the Servian constitution. In other words, they ascribed this to Servius Tullius, the king who came between the two Tarquins. What they say is as follows. They say that Servius Tullius came around and instituted a wide-ranging series of reforms. He disposed of the three original tribes of Roman people, which seem to have or may have been organized along ethnic lines. Remember, we saw that the very earliest fledgling state of Rome had adopted many Sabines into its midst, and some scholars believe that this is the origin of the tribes, to divide the original units of Roman society out from each other ethnically. Well, whatever the case about that, the three original tribes, they're often called the Romulian tribes, the tribes established by Romulus, were replaced by Servius Tullius, we are told, by 20 tribes, now determined by location. In other words, the tribes are like parishes or boroughs, and one enters a tribe by being born into a certain location, or living in a certain location. So these are essentially local units, and we are told he had four urban tribes, four that were based in the city, and 16 that were based in the countryside. Fair enough. We're also told by Livy and Dionysius that Servius then instituted a system of classes based upon wealth. He divided the Roman citizen body. Remember, all this applies now to adult males only. He divided the citizen body into five classes based upon their wealth. These classes he then organized into units called centuries, which were a military organization, according to our sources. They were units in the army. So you would have had soldiers, according to this reconstruction, you would have had soldiers divided up by wealth, equipped differently, depending on how they could actually afford to equip themselves. Finally, he used this military organization as the basis to create a new popular assembly, which was called the Comitia Centuriata, the Centuriate Assembly. The people assembled in centuries. We have the Curiate Assembly in one hand, the people assembled in their curiae. Now we have a new series of voting blocks, the people assembled in centuries. And according to our traditions, these centuries were assigned to the different classes in such a way that the richer classes had an advantage. Remember, the voting is done in the blocks, in the voting blocks of centuries, not by individual. So if you have more centuries assigned to the numerically fewer richer people, they'll have a greater advantage in the voting in that assembly. So in other words, this is a complex situation. We have Servius Tullius instituting new tribes, a new military order, and then using that military order as the basis for a new political order. All of this is supposed to have come out of the head of Servius Tullius in the mid-6th century BC. It can be shown that this is impossible. It can be shown from the evidence of Dio, of Dionysius and Livy themselves. In the year 495 BC, these same authors who have reported the Servian constitution tell us that in 495 BC, two new tribes were added because of the expansion of Roman territory, bringing the total, they tell us, to 21. Hang on a minute. I thought Servius Tullius had introduced 20 tribes. If the total reached 21 in 495 BC, where's that missing tribe? The answer is undoubtedly that this latter picture is the more correct one, that the number of local tribes grew piecemeal, incrementally, in pace with the expansion of Roman territory. It makes sense. The idea that they just came out of Servius Tullius's head is much more unlikely. And we can say, for instance, that some of the names of the tribes, even the ones that are supposed to have been created by Servius Tullius, are anachronistic. For instance, one tribe is called Tribe Claudia. clearly named after the influential patrician clan, the Claudii. But those guys didn't come to Rome till 504 BC, 50 years or more after Servius Tullius. So it can be shown, then, that these details are questionable, that the ancient sources have simplified a more complex evolutionary process and ascribed it all, pigeonholed it, under Servius Tullius. What's more, the division of the people into five classes is very difficult, because especially five classes of centuries to fight in the army. The Romans at this stage fought in, as I've said, in the phalanx formation. What you need is a large round shield, a spear, a breastplate, helmet, and a sword. If you can afford it, a piece of armour for your lower leg called a greave, which covers your knee down, the shield covering your thigh. Okay? You can't go in sort of missing the shield into a phalanx. It isn't as if you can say, listen, I can afford most of the equipment, but I can't afford the spear. I can still push up my shield. Or I can headbutt the guy or whatever. Or I can't afford a helmet. In other words, the division of people into five classes assumes a more complex military situation than the phalanx would seem to allow. Specifically, since this division is accredited in our sources as being instituted for military purposes originally. Surely the only division is between those who can afford the equipment and those who can't. Why aren't there just two classes? Maybe that's what Servius Tullius did originally. He made a classification of people into those who can afford it, for the equipment, and those who can't. But this later division into five classes reflects a more complex military order, which we know the Romans instituted towards the end of the 5th century. At this point, they divided their troops into units called maniples. Okay? And they began to operate in a more tactically complex fashion on the battlefield, with a grade of equipment involved. The five classes of soldier much better fit that picture, i.e. a late 5th century BC development, than they do a mid 6th century BC development. Again, what we seem to have in our sources is a conflation of a more complex evolutionary process packed in together into one single unit and presented to us as the product of a single man operating in a single brief period. This, then, is the broad shape of Roman society. We'll be seeing again the Comitia Centuriata when we look at the Republic, and it is, in fact, to the establishment of the Republic that I will turn our attention the next time round. I hope, though, that some of the difficulties of trying to interpret the data for the regal period have been made clear to you. You can see how it is that our sources are often contradictory, and how, once more, at the heart of everything in trying to analyse all this data is the issue of interpretation and argument and the presentation of contrary and competing reconstructions of events. That is the heart of ancient history, as I said in Lecture 1, and I hope by now everyone has got that message loud and clear.